Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Hugo and the Maiden by S.M. LaViolette, narrated by Ella Lynch. Chapter 1. London. Hugo tightened his grip on the Duchess of Beckington's narrow hips and plunged into her, filling the spacious bedchamber with the sound of skin slapping against skin, and making the huge four-poster bed shudder with his savage vigour. He was servicing Her Grace exactly the way she liked it. Rough, hard, and, yes, with lots of vulgar, earthy language.
"Admit you've been a wicked hussy, and beg for what you need," he ordered, smacking her buttock hard enough to sting his hand. Her spine arched, and she gave a low, guttural groan.
"Please, Hugo, I've been so naughty. Punish me with your cock. I need it."
A smile of genuine amusement twisted his lips as he grasped the thick, silver and black rope of hair that had fallen over one of her shoulders, pulled her head back until her neck was arched at a cruel angle, and commenced to ride her even harder. Hugo had to admit, there was nothing quite like rogering a peeress of the realm as roughly as a stallion covered a mare. Not to mention making her beg for it. Well, he reflected, that wasn't entirely accurate. Rogering a royal duke, something Hugo did 3 or 4 times a year, did outrank servicing a duchess. He grinned at the obnoxious thought and leaned forward to bite her shoulder. Not hard enough to draw blood the way he'd seen horses do, but hard enough to leave an angry red mark. And hard enough to send the Duchess flying over the edge into bliss. Hugo stilled, keeping himself buried deep inside her as she convulsed around him. He ignored his own incipient orgasm, like a good whore should, while she climaxed, her contractions exquisite agony around his aching shaft. When her shoulders began to sag with exhaustion, he reached beneath her and teased a second orgasm from her remarkably responsive body. He was ready to keep going, but again she begged,
"Please, Hugo, no more. I can't bear it, please."
So that was it then. He gripped the base of his still erect yard to hold the sheath on his body while he pulled out. Even though he rarely spent in a punter, or a client, as Melissa liked to call them, he always wore a sheath. That was his only rule when it came to whoring, and it was a rule he would never break. He had seen far too many old whores wandering the streets with faces like open sores, their minds eaten by the pox. Lady Beckington gave a soft mewl of satisfaction and rolled onto her side, her tall, thin body tangling in the rose-coloured silk sheeting that cost more than a housemaid earned in a decade. Hugo stripped off the sheath and discarded it in the small brass rubbish bin tucked unobtrusively beneath a gilt-edged nightstand. Unlike the streets, or in some of the seedier brothels, you never needed to reuse such things at the White House, or Solange's, as it was now called. Hugo pulled the bedding up over the Duchess's slender form, once again impressed by her vigour. For a woman in her late 50s, she was far more active and adventurous than many of his younger clients. Sometimes she wanted him 2 or 3 times during an evening. Sometimes she wanted him and another man. That was fine by Hugo. She paid a packet for him, and he had no qualms about working tandem. Hugo padded across the room and poured water into the wash basin. He took his time bathing the sweat from his face and neck before wiping down his chest and groin. He disliked leaving sweat to cool on his body and despised feeling sticky. He cut a glance at himself in the oval mirror that hung over the tall boy dresser, and then wished he hadn't. Every time Hugo saw his reflection, it surprised and disappointed him. For some reason, he always looked different in his mind's eye. His nose smaller, aquiline and elegant, his lips fuller, his eyes a sky blue, instead of the colour of peat. In effect, Hugo imagined himself handsome. Or at least marginally attractive, and certainly not the dark-eyed, dark-haired, harsh-featured and vaguely sinister-looking man he saw in the mirror. He would have liked to be taller and have the slim, graceful build of an aristocrat, but he was only of medium height, and his hard, muscular body was sculpted with brutal precision rather than sleek elegance. Still, for all that he was such an ugly sod, it seemed that scads of women, and not a few men, couldn't keep their eyes or hands off him. That was fine by Hugo. If somebody offered him enough money, he would fuck them. Female or male, it made no difference to him. They could beat him with birch switches and ride him as hard as a willful hack. They could have him beat them. They could dress up in a nappy and call him Papa. Hugo didn't give a damn. He only drew the line at anything involving children and animals. Yes, even a soulless, damned-to-hell whore like Hugo had his limits. He knew that most men, including several who worked in the brothel, believed that taking it up the arse was effeminate, not to mention dangerous and illegal. But Hugo didn't give a damn about any of that. He was in this business to make money, not to impress anyone. Certainly not other whores or the punters who paid them. Besides, male customers paid even more than women like the Duchess did, both for what Hugo did with them as well as what he did afterward, which was keep his gob shut. Hugo kept Mum as much for himself as anyone else. After all, if he were caught with another man, it wouldn't be just his client's neck in a noose. Being a sod was cause enough for death. Being a poor sod was almost a guarantee that you'd get the rope. Hugo poured fresh water over the soft cotton cloth and wrung it out before wiping down his arms and legs. His popularity among their clients had never stopped mystifying him. There wasn't a night when customers weren't lining up for him. Of course, his appeal was limited to sexual attraction. Hugo's thin lips twisted with derision. People didn't flock to him for his sparkling conversation or lively wit, and none of his faithful clients ever made the mistake of imagining that they'd fallen in love with him. He glanced over his shoulder at the Duchess. Not that he was supposed to know her name or rank. Inside these rooms, she was plain Mrs. Ellen Fletcher. To offer her a fresh cloth. But she was a silent lump on the bed, so he tossed the cloth aside. The false names were another holdover of Melissa Griffin's, the prior owner of Solange's, many rules. But Hugo had been born to break rules, and he made it his business to know exactly whom he was sticking his cock into. Why the hell would he put almost every penny he'd ever earned into Solange's unless he could control the variables of his whoring? Hugo went back to the bed to snuff out the candle on the nightstand and check on her grace. He'd worn her out and knew from experience that she would sleep until it was time for her to go if he didn't wake her. Some nights he let her sleep. Others he gave her more than she paid for. It was only good business. Besides, he didn't mind fucking her. Not that he got any relief from it. It wasn't that he couldn't climax with a client. It was that he rarely let himself take that ultimate pleasure, because all it did was fog his brain and make him feel like he was something other than a paid servant. He was especially careful around such a rarefied creature as a duchess, which were about as common as unicorns in Hugo's experience, and always kept in mind that she was paying him for her pleasure, not his. Hugo paused a moment to study her features. The duchess wasn't what you'd call beautiful, but she had a face that drew a man's gaze and held it. Even now, with mostly grey hair and deep lines around her eyes and mouth, she was a handsome woman. She was also exactly 25 years older than him. Today was both their birthdays, although he'd not shared that information with Her Grace. While Hugo made it his business to know whom he was servicing, he also made sure his clients didn't know a damned thing about him. At least, nothing but the bits of information he'd carefully created and provided. The Duchess of Beckingdon reminded him of a horse with impeccable bloodlines. You could tell just by looking at her that she was the product of generations of careful breeding. The same could not be said for Hugo, who resembled a street cur. Even his costly, tasteful clothing couldn't disguise his rough features or hide the fact that his eyes were permanently hungry, no matter how much he ate or how much money he had. Hugo snatched up one of the heavy silk robes provided for both clients and their companions and slipped his arms into it. Companion was yet another term of art that Melissa had coined. The word still made him laugh, even though he'd been whoring at Solange's for well over a decade, the last three of those years as an owner. He frowned. Well, co-owner. He tied the black silk sash around his waist and strode into the sitting room that adjoined each of the bedchambers on this side of the house, the ladies' side. His own garments hung on the hooks where he'd left them, and he fished a ruby-encrusted silver case from his coat pocket. The case was a gift from the Duchess, and the vile cigars inside it were from one of his other clients, a member of the Spanish royal family, if you believed what the man had told Hugo. The cigars stank, but there was something about them Hugo couldn't resist. He poured himself a healthy measure of the fine brandy the Duchess paid to have stocked and went to the huge fire that roared in the fireplace, yet another luxury the Duchess paid for. He took a spill from a glass bowl on the mantel and lit the cigar, tossing the small twist of paper into the fire before lowering himself into the big leather wingback chair nearest the blaze. Even though it was late summer, he was cold. He was always cold.
"You are terribly avertissement for my cooking, Hugo. You have no fat on you."
Oliver, the French chef who terrorized Solange's kitchen staff, as well as slaughtering the English language, had yelled at Hugo more than once. Hugo ate almost constantly, but his body burnt food the way this huge fireplace consumed coal. No matter how much he ate, he remained lean, nothing but skin stretched taut over muscle, bone, and sinew. He exhaled a plume of dirty brown smoke, his jaws tightening as he contemplated the woman who owned the other 50% of this venture and was occupying his thoughts far too often these days. Laura Maitland was at least 10 years older than Hugo and had been working at the exclusive brothel for over 20 years. She should have earned enough money to buy the brothel twice over, but Laura had a strong thirst for gin and cards, both of which had left her life in tatters. It had been lucky for Laura that Melissa Griffin had discovered the other woman's addiction and taken charge of her before Laura could lose everything she had, including her life. Even with Melissa's help, it had taken Laura years to pay her debts and save any money. 3 years ago, when Melissa sold the brothel, Laura had finally scraped up enough money to buy half. Hugo had been furious. He'd saved for years to buy the place, but Mel refused to sell him the entirety of the business, insisting that she had an obligation to Laura. And so Hugo was stuck with Laura. He'd had to put up with the woman's drunkenness for 3 long years, and he'd also had to advance her money repeatedly for her share of the business expenses. While she'd been drinking and gambling, Hugo had worked twice as much, taken twice as many clients, and saved every penny. He was ready to buy her out. Hugo doubted that Laura would even consider an offer from him if she hadn't begun seeing a big, brutal bastard named Cowan Morgan about 6 months ago. It was the first time Hugo had known Laura to take a regular lover, but then she was getting a bit long in the tooth to attract the young, handsome men who'd once flocked to her in droves. It wasn't only her age, but all the drink that had taken its toll. Cowan had been lurking around Solange's far too much for Hugo's comfort, but the man worked as an enforcer for the Welsh crime lord, Bevan Davis, so Hugo couldn't exactly chase him off. Nobody in their right mind offended anyone connected to Davis. And so Hugo had tolerated Morgan's presence. But the man was greedy and stupid, and Hugo suspected that he might encourage Laura to accept an offer to buy her out. As dumb as Cowan looked, Hugo knew the man had to know that Laura lost more of the business every month she owned it. Hugo didn't think it would be too hard for Cowan to convince her to sell and get away. especially since Laura hated Hugo with such a virulent hatred. Hugo grinned. There was nothing like a woman scorned when it came to hating. The animus between them was mutual, and dated back to his first week at the brothel, when Laura had shown up in Hugo's bedroom, naked beneath her dressing gown. He'd been bloody amazed at her cheek. Hell, he had sex for a living. Did the woman really believe that was how he wanted to spend his free time? Not bloody likely. That long ago night, after he'd told Laura that if she wanted to have sex with him, she could pay him just like any other customer, she'd shaken with fury and had hated him ever since. Laura wasn't the only person he'd angered with that sort of rejection. His steadfast refusal to take lovers had caused no small amount of heartburn over the years. Well, that was too damned bad. The last thing he wanted was to throw his lot in with anyone else, especially another whore. Other people were a burden he didn't need. He'd spent the first 20 years of his life in poverty and want. He fully intended to spend the rest of it in comfort and luxury. His plan for the future was a simple one. Get control of Solange's, one way or another, and operate the brothel until he died. He had no desire to move to a cottage in the country and grow turnips and raise chickens, or whatever the hell it was an old whore did once they didn't whore anymore. He enjoyed what he did, and had no interest in quitting. He flicked the stub of his cigar into the flames and took another pull from his brandy. He didn't want a lover, and he didn't want friends. All he wanted was money. Lots and lots and lots of money. At the end of the day, money was the only thing that mattered. Without it, you were weak, vulnerable, and at the mercy of the rest of the world. And the world was a cold, cruel, ugly place, and human beings were the worst part of it. The only person on the entire planet that Hugo trusted was Hugo. And if that bothered other people, well, they could go sod themselves. He didn't give a damn who hated him, how much, or why. In fact, he was used to people hating him. Hell, his own father had hated him so much that he'd sold Hugo to a stranger, and a twisted one at that. So, yes, thank you very much. He was quite comfortable with hatred. Mr. Hugo? He looked up to find one of the maids, Mindy, standing in the doorway. She was pale, shaking and wringing her hands. What's the matter, sweetheart? He asked, putting down his glass and getting to his feet. It's Mrs. Maitland. Something has happened to her and... She shook her head and looked away, biting her lower lip. Hope surged in his breast. Is she ill? Or perhaps dead? God, he was such a bastard. Oh, please, Mr. Hugo, come and see. I can't bear to look at her. Hugo couldn't bear to look at the woman either. He decided poor Mindy was too overwrought to see the humour in such a comment. He followed her from the room, not even bothering to put on his slippers. Is Mr. Morgan with her? He asked, as they padded down the hushed corridor. No, sir, she's all alone. Laura's quarters were in the same part of the house as his. The employees lived in one area, which meant he and Mindy had to go all the way to the other side of the building. By the time they reached the stairs leading to Laura's apartment, Hugo was breathing hard, mainly from suppressed excitement. If Laura died, Hugo had first right of refusal on her half of the business. He knew it made him a bad person to hope something had befallen her. But that's because he was a bad person. He'd made peace with that years ago. Mindy stopped in front of Laura's door, which was ajar. There was a sliver of light coming from somewhere beyond the door, and Hugo stuck his head inside. Laura? Blinding agony exploded in his skull. His vision went black, and Hugo dropped to the floor like a sack of potatoes. Tie his hands. He's a skinny bastard, but he's strong. A voice he didn't recognise ordered. Hugo shook his head to try and clear his vision, and promptly vomited from the pain. Bleeding hell, somebody muttered. Hugo tried to reach up and keep his skull from exploding, but his wrists had been tied behind his back. When had that happened? Pick him up. Rough hands grabbed him around his middle, and he went flying through the air and landed on something hard. A shoulder? Just before his head smacked into another hard object. Blackness and pain pulled him under. When he came to, he was lying face down on rough, smelly leather.
"What's happening?"
His words came out choked with drool.
"You hear that? The tough bastard is awake again."
Somebody chuckled.
"I think he needs another sleeping draught."
Once again, Hugo's head exploded. This time, he gave up swimming against the darkness and slid into blessed oblivion. Chapter 2. The Island of Stroma, North Coast of Scotland. Martha Pringle hurried toward the cluster of lights moving erratically at the north end of the island. Everyone on Stroma knew, when the church bell rang at this hour of the night, that a ship had failed to clear the rocks. Now it was just a matter of how bad things were, or how good they were, depending on the person's point of view. She grimaced at the cynical thought.
"You should be ashamed of yourself, Martha Jean Pringle."
"Have a care, Martha. The trouble will wait for us to get there safely," her father said, his words more of a wheeze.
"I'm sorry, Father."
She slowed her pace. If not for her own safety, then certainly for his. At 76, Jonathan Pringle was as agile as a man half his age. But Martha knew that old bones were brittle, and it would only take one break to put an end to his active existence. People did not mend quickly at his age.
"Did you bring the black bag, Martha?"
"Yes, Father."
"And the torches we made last month?"
"Yes, Father. I brought everything."
Martha hoped most of it wouldn't be needed, and that the lights meant something other than what she feared. They reached the tiny shingle beach in time to see several of the distinctive boats that the islanders called yoles push off the shore and head out toward the dark shadow near the rocks.
"My, that is a large ship," her father said as Robert Clark approached.
Mr. Clark was a strapping, handsome man who acted in the capacity of harbour master, although Stroma had no actual harbour. Only small boats could be brought near Stroma, as the beach was the sole point of access, with sheer, craggy cliffs bordering the rest of the island.
"Good evening to you, Miss Pringle," Mr. Clark said, nodding at Martha,
his admiring look one that made her cheeks heat. Mr. Clark was attractive and unmarried, and Martha wasn't the only woman in their tiny village who found his person engaging.
"Good evening, Mr. Pringle," he said to her father. "She is a big vessel," he said in response to her father's comment, crossing thick arms over his muscular chest as he turned to stare out at the dark form. "Jane Packard got close enough to see she's called the King's Folly. I've never seen her in these waters before, so I reckon she must have wandered off course."
Martha could not tell from Mr. Clark's expression whether the ship had received any help wandering into the rocks that surrounded that part of the island. Although her father said nothing, she knew the question would be weighing heavily on his mind as well. The only area of dissension between the islanders and their vicar, an outsider to Stroma, for all that he'd served the small community for two decades, was their wrecking activities. To a man or woman, they would have denied it, but the people of Stroma were known up and down the coast as wreckers, men and women who lured ships to their ruin and stripped them of their cargoes. Clark cleared his throat.
"The ship looks like a transport, which makes me think her destination was New South Wales." "You mean a ship for prisoners?" her father asked, his eyes widening in disbelief. "Aye."
"And yet she is up here?" Martha asked.
"It is unusual, there is no denying that," Clark admitted. "My guess is the convicts were locked in the hold, maybe even chained. I think many won't make it out alive."
"Jesus wept," her father said, swaying like a reed in the wind. Martha put her arm around him and sucked in a breath when she realised how fragile his shoulders felt beneath her hand. Jonathan Pringle had never been a big man, but he'd always been healthy. Now he felt as insubstantial as a bird.
"Martha brought our medical bag," her father told Mr. Clark,
Where would you like us to set up? Actually, I think you should open up the meeting hall to treat survivors.
That's quite a walk. You wouldn't rather use the church? Mr. Pringle asked.
The church was the largest building on Stroma, and also close to the beach. When Mr. Clark hesitated, the vicar smiled.
I know tomorrow is Sunday, but the Lord will understand why we can't have our usual service.
Clark looked uncomfortable. We'll need the church for other purposes, sir. I'm afraid the dead will outnumber the living this night.
It was ironic that Hugo probably owed his life to being a piss-poor sailor. From the moment he'd woken up half-naked aboard the ship, he'd begun puking. Shackled and chained to men on both sides of him and crammed in with convicts all around him, he'd quickly become the most unpopular man on board. Nobody wanted to get near him. Sometime in the middle of the third or fourth night, he'd lost track. The prisoners around him had finally had enough of the inhumane conditions and began to riot. Hugo could have told them that his stomach was, by then, as empty as a killer's conscience, and that if they'd but waited another few hours, he would have coughed up his innards, and that would have been the end of it. But his fellow convicts had long since lost any interest in being reasonable. A riot with men chained to one another could only lead to one thing. Some men living, some men dying. Once the violence broke out, those in charge of the prisoners simply shut the two huge hatches to the ship's hold, periodically opening them just enough to toss down food and lower the occasional bucket of water. Hugo discovered that the best way to avoid becoming a dead convict was to be so covered in puke that nobody wanted to touch you. So he crammed his back up against the splintery hull and watched the fighting, puking weakly from time to time. It was soon evident which of the convicts had been arrested for crimes against property and which for crimes against their fellow man. The compulsion to steal a loaf of bread, usually driven by hunger, could not compete with the compulsion to kill or rape, two actions Hugo had witnessed more than once growing up in the rookeries. Luckily for him, the two men chained closest to him were of the former variety. When the killing began, they both squashed themselves against Hugo, like hens huddling for warmth, no longer put off by a little puke. The three of them watched the horrifyingly lethal proceedings with growing terror as the days passed. Their curiosity leavened with a healthy dose of self-interest. It took no time for one prisoner to reach the top of the pile. The man was a mountain of a brute, whose small piggy eyes were those of a person who enjoyed exercising dominion over others. Once he'd made it clear that he was in charge, the situation in the hold settled into an uneasy peace. But then, no food or water came down the following day, and none the day after. The big man, Graybo was the name tattooed in uneven blue letters across his massive chest, seemed to go mad on the third day, sawing off the foot of the man attached to him with a wicked rusty blade he appeared to have snatched from thin air. The prisoner on Hugo's right prayed loudly, while the one on his left had taken up where Hugo left off and was puking, or at least heaving, since there was nothing left to bring up. Graybo then sawed off the foot of the man on his left. When he'd finished, he forced the terrified prisoners nearest to him to form a human platform, which he climbed to reach the hatch doors and began beating on them. This went on for hours. As the daylight that bled through the planks overhead faded, Hugo looked from the maniac's broad back to the rest of the convicts. Other than a few who were actively supporting Graybo, or themselves sawing off body parts of the men chained to them, most of the prisoners were as terrified as Hugo's two neighbours. Hugo no longer had the energy to be afraid. He would rather die then and there, at least he'd escape the vile smell in the hold, than suffer through another day in hell. Do you want to live? The words came out of his mouth without direction from his brain. His two companions' heads swiveled in his direction. You heard me, he said. When neither spoke, he turned to the one who'd been praying, a younger man who resembled a human matchstick with his flaming red hair. What about you, Vicar? Do you want to live? The lad nodded.
Hugo turned to the other man. How about you, Puker? Eyes wide, the second man nodded too.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?